Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. So we had that Downers Grove Village Board meeting last night, the one that we previewed yesterday that was... On the agenda was to remove a library board trustee named Bill Nienberg, who actually will join us at 6 o'clock to give us his perspective. He was not in attendance last evening. He was traveling for business. No, he would have been there had he been in town, but he has a job apparently and it requires him to travel. And obviously that takes priority over a volunteer position with the board, particularly when that is mainly to be a whipping post for the leftists on both the village board as well as this library board, appointed by the village board. Interesting wrinkle, some of you listening who pay attention to municipal government. You know, most communities, the library board is elected because it's a separate unit of government. In Downers Grove, they're appointed with separate budgets, but they're appointed by the mayor. So as Mayor Barnett of Downers Grove said, you know, he and the board bear some responsibility for the composition of the library board of trustees. Indeed, they do. Indeed, he does. So here was a portion of the statement that Bill Nienberg drafted that was read by his brother-in-law during public comment section. His brother-in-law, also a volunteer for the village of Downers Grove on the police pension board. And I got to tell you, just as the backdrop before we really get into this, this was a real microcosm of the suburbs. Mm-hmm. You want to understand why and how DuPage has become what it's become, how suburban Chicago was lost, and who won? Watch that board meeting, or at least some portion of it. I sat through about an hour and 45 minutes of the public comment and the village trustees' comments. It is so instructive. So if you can, you know, take your eyes off Manhattan for a minute in the presidential race and pay attention to where you live, the government that has the most impact on you, the power that is closest to you, where you'll find a lot of explanation for why these communities have lost. If you're scratching your head, how did these schools become what they are today? How did DuPage become what it is today? How did it, Chicago Metro in Illinois? A lot is contained in the interplay of citizens at the local level on boards like the library board and certainly the village board. Very instructive. Here's Nienberg's brother-in-law reading a portion of the statement, I should say, that he read on behalf of his brother-in-law.
Tonight's vote is without a shred of due process. The board censure was a blindside attack on me, orchestrated to happen when I was out of town and could not defend it. The only steps to open a dialogue with counsel have only been the ones that I've been initiated. I haven't had and apparently won't have any official audience with the counsel. But you either are content to say that that doesn't apply, or you're willing to admit it just doesn't matter. Cherish standards like facing your accuser, defending charges against you, innocent until proven guilty, not to mention free speech, are all the real casualties here. The residents of Downers Grove who want to see a disciplined, fiscally responsible, and centered library where they can safely and confidently bring their children without worrying what they will be exposed to are being abandoned. The latest activist programming will replace my push for innovation to keep our library relevant in a changing world. Counsel, you're about to engage in a complete miscarriage of justice.
Well, that's what they do. And don't forget, Bill Nienberg, I mean, we'll get color on this, but essentially his crimes against humanity that drew the 5-0 censure from the board of leftist apparatchiks appointed by a board that's controlled by leftist apparatchiks. And we'll get to them. He wouldn't post his preferred pronouns on the website, the library website. He opposed spending $157,000 on a race hustler, one of these DEI consultants, come in and, you know, tell you how bad white people are. He opposed the drag queen bingo event that was to be held at the library featuring a self-described raunchy stripper, a man pretending to be a woman, gyrating at the library in front of kids. Those are his fundamental crimes against the board. And apparently he wasn't properly deferential. He wasn't demure in expressing his opinions. And so he gets censured and he gets referred to the board for what they term gross misconduct. And that was the issue they took up yesterday.
I mean, he won't call people by pronouns and he's against strippers in the library. Think about
those are outrageous positions. I know.
I mean,
I know you're shocked
he?
As I am.
He should be tarred and feathered. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Now, on the good news front, you did have a lot of residents show up, a lot of Downers Grove residents show up.
Good.
I'm sure dozens more than normally attend these village board meetings to stand up for Bill Nienberg. I'll give you a couple of examples of those, Allison Volker, she came to make a statement on behalf of Nienberg.
What we will continue to observe what is on display here, that unless you get in line and agree with every item on the Progressive Library Board agenda, it's an all-or-nothing approach after all, you'll be censured, you'll be removed from your position, and a warning to the Downers Grove residents, it's not going to stop with the Library Board.
Nope.
As a parent, one of my biggest responsibilities is to teach my kids to be independent thinkers. I say this because I'm hoping other parents in the room and those watching online or listening at home will step back and question if the community that claims to prioritize diversity is fostering diversity in thought. As Mayor Barnett, and this is the second reference to it, said in a previous meeting, we will be standing next to each other in the Jewel Line tomorrow. Our kids will be going to school tomorrow. They'll be playing sports together. What are we teaching them? That if your thoughts on any of the topics oppose the progressive narrative of the Downers Grove Library or any other handful of institutions in this town, that you will be labeled and you will be silenced.
Allison Volker, obviously a venomous hate monger.
I mean, she should be kicked out of Downers Grove.
I think they
sent
will.
Sent to Hinsdale, maybe. I don't know.
The board will be moving a motion to excommunicate Allison Volker, to have her house seized and her children ripped out of the schools and sent to Westmont, where she will live in shame and exile. Downers Grove resident Nancy Sullivan.
And I went to many library meetings, and I heard Bill. I saw him try to make inroads with this board. I sat there quietly watching, cringing, wondering, where were other people with his thoughts? Nowhere. Everybody votes the same. Everybody says the same thing. Yay, 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 yay. I want a board that doesn't agree. That's what a good board has, disagreement. So in the future, should you not keep him on this board, I hope you assign someone just like him to this board. Because we need Bill Nienbergs in this town. There's a famous line that Michael Jordan said when they asked him about, why don't you get political, Michael? He said, conservatives buy gym shoes too. Well, I take out books too. And I don't feel in this town that our voice is heard a lot.
Nancy Sullivan has not been heard from since she made that statement at the Downers Grove board meeting. Brian in St. John, Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I've been telling people for a long time the libraries are as big of a problem as schools. The way they do it out here in Lake County, Indiana, which is a big, big district, there's several libraries throughout the area. But every board member on the library is appointed, so they're, none are elected. And I've been to the library many times with my two young kids, and I have seen very disturbing books in the kids section. And I have formally opposed some of the books, and I lose every time because they're always acceptable to the library standard. And the issue I have is the Lake County Public Library Board meets one day a month, I think it's like the second Monday in a month, at 4 p.m. So a working person like me can't even get to a meeting to talk to them or to speak in public comment about my opposition to a book. So quite disturbing. That's all I got.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Well, let's just remember, I know we have sort of this romantic notion of what the library is. I remember going to the Wheaton Library growing up and very helpful, learning the Dewey Decimal System and talking to a librarian if I need a reference material. I need to look at this microfiche. How old am I? I get it, but that's not, you know, the libraries today, and this is a blanket statement, there are exceptions. But just look at who the American Library Association president is, this Emily Drabinsky. We've profiled her on the show before. She's this, you know, LGBTQ, two-spirit, plus, and a self-described Marxist. This is a haven for leftist activism for the neo-Marxists, the identitarian goon squad, just as the schools are, just as any repository of power or cultural significance are. So, you know, it's not that the bookish librarian who's just helping out the kids and otherwise sort of representing one of the pillars of a civilized community. It's just not that way anymore because, of course, politics has insinuated itself, and everywhere it does, it tends to destroy. And so that's what's happened in Downers Grove and to the library board and all of the paeans to we have this wonderful library. Notwithstanding, it is a place where opposing viewpoints are not welcome. You're perfectly welcome if you want to fall in line. And since Bill Nienberg didn't, he's out.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the Downers Grove Library Board. Oh, sounds rather parochial. Well, it's a small thing that represents a big thing. Like these other small fights in a particular community that are representative of the battles going on in every community to the extent that people of good sense and common decency choose to engage in the battle for the future of their community, their state, and their country. This is another case. Josh McBroom over Naperville, when he proposed the idea of looking at a sign-up list for Naperville residents who want to receive and bring migrants into their homes. And the furor that stirred in Naperville.
Greatest idea ever.
And, you know, these things like library districts, as anybody who pays attention knows, become little fiefdoms, too, and in some cases not so little. I mean, in Lombard, we brought you this story last year. People forget. A couple candidates ran for library board in Lombard on the basis of this, in opposition to it, as an illustration of what's wrong with the library board, why they need change. And, of course, Lombard voters summarily rejected that because Lombard has gone, too, as is Downers Grove, as is Naperville. The Lombard Library Board built a 50,000 square feet, $28 million library. It's the most expensive library in DuPage County, maybe in...
I think in the Midwest, maybe even the world.
I mean, $554 a square foot. It also includes custom marble. I hope they got the Italian stuff, the good stuff for Lombard.
I mean, if you're going to go big, you know, go heavy or go home.
So, I mean, this does have some relevance here, even if you don't live in Downers Grove. And as you listen to what the residents said in trying to persuade the board, and with four of the seven board members being Marxists, there was no persuasion path that was baked in. And most of the residents who spoke understood that, as did the three trustees in the minority, or the two trustees and the mayor. In the minority. So it's relevant to listen to these exchanges to understand the dynamics of the battles that are happening in your backyard, just as they are in D.C. They're not particularly different. But maybe it helps to crystallize it for some to hear it happening, you know, just on the block at the Village Hall. And by the way, Bill Nienberg, again, the library trustee who was removed last night. That's how the vote went, 4-3. Will join us at 6:06. So listen to the trustees, because he was removed, the referral by the library board to the village board, accused him of misconduct, gross misconduct. Martin Tully is a former mayor, and he's a on the board, he's a trustee. He's also an attorney. He picked up on that sort of threshold to distill that a bit, give some context to that word and the charge against Nienberg. And, you know, just sort of, and some of the residents who spoke did, just, you know, sort of take the, take up the issue of the norms of our free society, the small d democratic norms, things like due process, evidence. Nienberg's statement referenced these things as well. Take a listen to Martin Tully.
Is that the terms misconduct and neglect of office, if you can look at various definitions, but it usually includes something like willful violation of a law, harming persons or property, or attending meetings under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So, okay, real high standard. But again, this isn't a court of law, so it's not a beyond the reasonable doubt. I'm not suggesting that everyone has to do that or we have to have evidence or witnesses. But just in my mind, I can't get away from that. That standard isn't even close to being met here. Not even close. I haven't heard one thing yet that comes even within a time zone of that standard. It's no surprise I've never been happy that this came before us in the first place. And again, I just said we don't have to consider the resolution, but there is a censorship resolution that the library put forward that has 3 points in it. Those 3 points, I've looked at it, I've read it, I've talked to people, I've read the documents, I've read the bylaws. They are at best specious and probably demonstrably false. I mean, they just are. I mean, just read the documents, and that's not what they say. The misrepresenting position as a trustee is a stretch at best. I won't repeat what was said by Commissioner Glover, but the bylaws just don't say that. I mean, even the language of the resolution is has all kinds of wiggle room in it because it was written as though somebody wasn't quite sure it was going to fly. It just doesn't rise to that very high standard that I mentioned. And the third point is that Trustee Nienberg refused to work, or stated he refused to work with the other board members on any issue or policy after a motion that he put forward in January of 2024. I've done my own asking around and determined that's just not true. In fact, Bill Nienberg, Trustee Nienberg, has a history of working on other boards for this very village. He didn't just pop into the Downers Grove one day, show up on the library board. He worked in other boards and commissions very effectively. Now, other people who have worked with him on, say, the Economic Development Commission, for example, say that, yeah, he had some pretty strong opinions. But they were very valuable, and they contributed to an overall good solution for different issues. So this is not somebody that didn't have a history of working well with others. Sorry that this all happened here. That's unfortunate. But I just don't buy it. It's not misconduct or the neglect of office.
Yeah, not by any rational person's definition of those terms. He's not accused of embezzling funds or abusing staff any of the other examples that Tully gave. This is real simple. He was obstreperous. I mean, what we would define is just he just disagreed, but they, he was disruptive. He was disruptive because you have five board members that are Marxists and Bill Nienberg. And he wasn't falling in line. And you're about to hear exactly that. And it doesn't take much reading between the lines to understand who the ringleader is and what the ringleader's philosophy is. And that ringleader's philosophy is the dominant philosophy in village government in Downers Grove and based on their elected representation in Downers Grove writ large. Leslie Sadowski Fugit. If that's how you pronounce her hyphenated last name. I don't know about the Fugit. Fugit? Fugit? Potato? She is a potato head. Leslie Sadowski Fugit. She angry.
I will simply state that there is ample evidence to support that Trustee Nienberg has not acted in the best interests of the Downers Grove Public Library, and in some cases disparaged marginalized populations and minimized their harassment by board meeting attendees. He consistently comes to meetings of those which he attends unprepared. This goes against the bylaws and creates an unsafe work environment for staff and fellow trustees.
Unsafe.
Coaching and conversations have been offered from my understanding. In my case, after I was supposed to meet with him and my daughter ended up sick, so I had to cancel a coffee because I had to stay home with her from school. Despite reaching out to reschedule that offer, I was never taken up on it again. I know I'm not the only one who had that happen. And
bring your kids into it. Okay.
So the buzzwords are all here, and there's more from Leslie Sadowski Fugit in just a second. Unsafe. Some way that's undefined, because, of course, there's nothing in what she said that is an explanation for a position. It's just a declaration, and this is what they do. He has disparaged marginalized communities. Could you be specific? No, I won't. Because to get into the specifics, as she argued, would be to take up something in public that should be in executive session because we're dealing with a personnel issue. Oh, of course. Oh, by the letters, Leslie Sadowski Fugit. She wouldn't want to invade Trustee Weinberg's privacy because she's so respectful. She's such a model of decorum and good governance. Of course. Thank you. You just essentially insinuate he's a racist in public. That's fine. No problem there. And he comes unprepared. I offered to coach him, but he failed to reschedule our coffee. Oh, my goodness.
And I have a kid at home where I had to stay home because she was sick.
And the unsafety of him allegedly coming to meetings unprepared. It's very interesting because on the one hand, he is not playing well with others on what they want to do, things like the drag queen bingo deal. On the other hand, he's unprepared. So he is pushing back again on the merits of some of the things the board did and wants to do. But on the other hand, he's unprepared. Okay. And here was the howler, and it wasn't lost on most in attendance.
I will simply state that there is ample evidence to support that trustee
because this has nothing to do with political affiliations and everything
please.
To Point deal
of order. Come on. Please,
with
folks, come on.
Dangerous extremism.
Dangerous extremism.
Hold not just here in Downers Grove or the western suburbs, but the entirety of the country. And I understand that may mean upsetting some of our base, but in reality, we need to be acting on behalf of the whole community's interests. In fact, I talk to my conservative neighbors, I'm sure everybody is shocked, all the time at the bus stop, walking around, about the library.
And they love you.
And I haven't met one that for the life of them can understand why there is a contingent of people who do not patronize the library and yet have a lot of feelings about what it should and shouldn't be. While my neighbors may not have understood drag queen bingo, and they didn't, they recognized that it was an event that was for them. And they believe that it must have held value for some and simply chose not to attend. An event, I might add, and has been repeated here today, that Trustee Nienberg said was not the best of what we had to offer.
How dare he? How dare he say a self-described raunchy male stripper masquerading as a woman to gyrate in a scantily, you know, in scantily clad wear in front of kids? How dare he say that's not the best of us? Oh, my God. What an affront. It's also telling that, I understand, Trustee Leslie Sadowski Fugit. This is all about Drag Queen Story Hour. You just, that's the tell. Misconduct and neglect of office. He was unprepared. He didn't do enough to represent or celebrate so-called marginalized communities in Downers Grove, right? So on and so forth. But all of this is just the window dressing. You just targeted him for elimination because he didn't go along with drag queen bingo.
Right, that's what this is about. I don't think it's about the pronouns. I think it's about that. They just threw that in there.
Oh, sure,
to make him
right.
look bad and make disparaging comments about him.
Sure, yeah. Once you gotta build a facade around the real issue, and that's the real issue. It's pretty clear. All this marginalized communities, and I talk to my conservative friends, and sure. Yeah, I'd love to hear if anybody knows Leslie Sadowski Fugit, this awful, angry, white leftist female, this harridan. She's angry. I mean, it's all there bubbling just below the surface, and she uses all the buzzwords, the implicit biases. And then, of course, it wouldn't be a Jeremiad from an awful if you didn't get the lecture about how you're supposed to live your life, you know, like she does, practicing the golden rule. Another howler.
My request to everyone out there is to take some time to reflect on these behaviors, like yelling out at your, you know, fellow residents. Are you treating others with the respect that you want to be treated? Have you had those one-on-one conversations with people that make you uncomfortable? Or do you simply show up to make inappropriate statements and leave before a meeting concludes? Don't attend other opportunities to engage in meaningful dialogue, and don't get back to people when they offer a coffee. While we as elected officials absolutely need to sit here quietly and let everyone say their piece as a First Amendment right, it does not mean that based on these very public statements that people will not face consequences for their actions, for example, breaking bylaws of institution. Throughout this process, I've been accused of lying about threats to the library. I've been called a thug, and I've also been called various other silly names. I signed up for this, and I can take it.
No, you
can't.
Well,
it's not right
Clearly,
for
you
us
can't.
To have to face harassment. We chose to be public officials. Library staff, our LGBTQ+ community members, and others didn't sign up for this. So I will use the role that I have up here and the role that I have in appointing and removing board members to prioritize the safety of staff and other trustees and the sanctity of our public institutions, which is why I put this motion forward.
If only Bill Nienberg would have rescheduled that coffee.
He could have saved his job. Why? I mean, my kid was sick.
Volunteer post. Yeah.
I made an effort. I mean, these people are, it's insufferable. I mean, they're whiny politicians, and they claim that they can't work with someone who has opposing views. And to the point where they'll just get rid of them.
She is, to call her a liar and a bully is to be too generous. Or a goon, a thug, whatever she was called. Whatever she was called and more is appropriate. She is a nasty, small-minded, ignorant, trollish, putty-faced goon. You want to talk about somebody that would be very comfortable in a guard tower. Leslie Sadowski Fugit. How dare you not reschedule that coffee?
She's making him pay for that.
You can say things. Oh, and the groaning when she said it's not political. Right. Because, I mean, you know, people will roll their eyes or groan when you're, you know, standing above them with no clothes, declaring yourself the empress. Yeah. They're not going to take you seriously because you're not a serious person, and they shouldn't. And let me say something too about Mayor Barnett. You know, I know he's trying to maintain civility and so on and so forth. He spent a lot of time doing what I hate, what I really despise politicians do. Hey! Don't applaud when after somebody says we're trying to get through these things. You can express yourself however you want. Oh, hey, don't. Come on, people. We're having a conversation here. It's messy. It is messy. It is messy, Mayor.
When you brought it upon yourselves.
When somebody is going to insult my intelligence, I may call them out. We may have a visceral reaction as a group to things that are beyond absurd uttered from our duly elected officials. So just holster all of your phony baloney civil discourse in protection of people that are in the business of trying to silence people with differing opinions, like this ghastly Leslie Sadowski Fugit. So you see, I know, you know, Mayor Barnett and Tully and Danny Glover, who's great in Lethal Weapon, those were the three who voted against removing Nyberg. So it's good that he did, and Barnett strikes me as a reasonable guy, but just spare us with the Model UN decorum rap, okay?
I mean, it's Downers Grove City Council.
Yeah, the adults at Downers Grove comported themselves fine. The statements that I saw, and I watched a good, I don't know, 40 minutes of them, even a couple that were in support of the resolution, were well within the lines and mostly intelligent. So just stop lecturing people about how they're always to comport themselves and talking, giving us the kindergarten version of how we're supposed to interact with one another. And these phony baloney hypocrites like Leslie Dowski Fugit wagging their finger and telling us about the golden rule. Spare me. Who the hell do you think you are? You shut up. I'm talking. Okay? And I'll show you whatever respect or lack of respect I feel is warranted in the moment as my temporary representative, Mayor, and others.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We spent the first hour talking about last night's Downers Grove Village Board meeting. the issue that we brought to you yesterday was this removal of a gentleman named Bill Nienberg from the library board by the village board, because in Downers Grove, library board trustees are appointed by the mayor. Mm-hmm. And the importance of this at the local level is, as I've said, it's a microcosm of what's happening around the country, certainly around DuPage County and around Chicagoland and Illinois. The kind of rapaciousness on display of the censorious left. And you can call yourself a nonpartisan board, and you can talk about consensus building all you want. You listen to Leslie Sadowski-Fugit for 3 minutes, and you go ahead and howl at the moon if you're going to try and convince me that this is not a bitter, vitriolic, angry, leftist partisan activist.
Text messages. Who wears the pants in Leslie's house?
Yeah. I hear she's a strong proponent of bringing marijuana dispensaries to Downers Grove, too. Oh, yeah. Getting some feedback from Downers Grove residents, a little bit more color on these individuals.
Defile yourselves even more, Downers Grove.
Yeah, I don't think it's she's winning the day on that issue yet. But, you know, yet, as you see these communities self-immolate. Greg Hose or Jose, whatever. He had something to say to people who, like residents who spoke up on behalf of Nienberg, and said, you know, what about viewpoint diversity on the board? You're basically just running him out of off the board on a rail because he disagrees with, you know, the manifestations of your ideological bent, which is indeed patently obvious, but of course denied by Leslie Sadowski-Fugit and others. Like Greg Hose, take a listen.
Those, including Mr. Nienberg, who would make this about a conservative viewpoint versus any other, only call attention to yet another breach. Mr. Nienberg is not the conservative representative, as he himself stated in an email to us. He doesn't represent any conservative constituency. His constituency is the entire village of Downers Grove, regardless of race, creed, color, sex, sexual orientation, or any other marker you might want to put out there. To those who have advocated for more conservative voices on the library board, heed this advice. It is entirely hypocritical to engage in viewpoint-based advocacy one moment while decrying it the next.
Heed this advice, Greg, who I guess holds himself out as some sort of attorney, but union attorney, so, you know. Heed this advice, Greg. By the way, Greg Hose, another one who's he's nonpartisan. Really? Right. He's a Democrat candidate for state rep against Ron Zandag. He's going to lecture. Hey, heed this advice to your fallacious line of reasoning. Nobody is suggesting that a conservative would only represent those who agree with them in any position. Library board, village board, president of the United States. That's obvious. To suggest that that is the position of anybody defending Bill Nienberg is to erect a straw man that you knock down, which is what hacks do. And you're a hack. You're a partisan hack, just as your fellow travelers on that board are. Chris Gilmartin, endorsed by Sean Kasten. Not a partisan, though. I proudly endorse Chris Gilmartin, Sean Kasten. And Sean Kasten's not a partisan either. Nobody's partisan. You know, it's funny. The Democrats are completely nonpartisan. It's just these extremists who disagree with them that are sullying our good government with partisan politics. Right.
Trustee Nienberg doesn't seem to show the slightest bit of reflection or ownership or humility in any of his former responses to his body, including the statement that was read to us tonight. His communication to the council has been simply denial, defiance, blame, and victimhood. Based on the lack of support from the balance of the board, his lack of effectiveness, and his lack of willingness to change, I'm compelled to support this resolution, and I will vote for it.
For more on this, please be joined by the aforementioned William Nienberg. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for bringing this issue up.
No, my pleasure. It's been illuminating, and I think so for our listeners as well. And obviously, as we know, these are fights that are happening, as I mentioned, in a lot of places, including recently. Josh McBroom in Naperville is a good example. But anyway, on to your case, we played a portion of the statement that your brother-in-law read on your behalf since you were unable to attend because you had work responsibilities. I don't know how much of it you've been able to see from last night, but there were many residents who spoke up on your behalf very thoughtfully. And then there was Leslie Sadowski-Fugit and Greg Hose and Chris Gilmartin, and Mayor Barnett on your side, but sort of somewhere in the middle intellectually. So, give us your perspective on this, and particularly if you want to respond to all the slime that was thrown in your direction from those trustees who moved this on you, please do.
Well, I had to stop watching after Leslie's comments because that was enough to remind me that I'd forgotten my blood pressure medicine at home and needed to go to bed. So I have to watch the rest of it to see what the other comments were. Leslie and many of the others are still grinding an axe from the drag queen bingo event from 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And this was the culmination of a 2-year-long effort to exact revenge for that, for my stance against that event.
Well, why don't you want the drag queen bingo?
Why don't I want the drag queen bingo?
Yeah, tell us.
It's a completely inappropriate event for a public library. That's a starting point. It doesn't afford the dignity that the LGBTQ community deserves. It is not the best representation of the LGBT community. If they wanted to celebrate Coming Out Day and help teens that are going through a period of life where they're coming to grips with their identity, there are much better ways to do that than trotting a sexualized drag queen event into a library.
It's funny. There was a resident who commented during public comment who said exactly that, and he was referencing a conversation he had with a gay friend of his who was also opposed to the drag queen bingo for the exact same reason. Why are they always presenting people who are gay as, you know, these like just hyper-sexualized individuals? So that's well within the bounds of substantive, thoughtful discourse on the topic. But yeah. I think what Leslie Sadowski...
I'm sure you guys remember David Olson, Representative Olson.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Who is part of the LGBT community. And when this happened, I asked David to come meet me for coffee because this is how it struck me. But I wanted to hear from someone who is in that life and who has lived that experience. And David validated my point of view that this is not how that community wants to be represented. And I think the gentleman that spoke last night did a good job of reinforcing that.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I supported David Olson when he replaced Sandak and when he ran for back when he ran for COD and then when he ran for state legislative office and ran for re-election and so forth. And so did Jeannie Ives. And I know that we're characterized, and I think we were characterized yesterday by Leslie Sadowski as part of the extremists that are ruining Downers Grove from afar and the country and all that. Supported David Olson. He's gay. Whatever. And then I stopped supporting him, not because he's gay, but because of his voting record on certain things where he did a 180 on us in terms of what he said he would do versus what he did. And I don't need to get into the details. But that's the sort of nuance that is just completely lost on the Leslie Sadowskis and the Greg Hoses and the Chris Gilmartins of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, this was not a conversation about David's political view. This is a conversation about David's feelings as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I speculated how that might feel, but he validated it. The other thing that Leslie was really infuriated about was, you know, she wanted to vilify everybody who was opposed to this event and paint them as anti-LGBTQ. And I made a comment from the dais that said, if you're opposed to this, you have every right to be opposed to this. And you should not bow to these attacks that try to paint you as intolerant or that you're motivated by hate. You can be motivated by right thinking and land on the side of opposition of a drag queen event in a library.
So why don't you go to a coffee with Leslie? She seemed a little
She's very upset you didn't reschedule that coffee so she could coach you up. Very upset.
I had no idea she was so offended about that coffee. That was approximately 2 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
And apparently this has been bothering her for 2 years, which makes me feel really bad.
She has difficulty letting go, I think, is pretty well established at this point.
She wants to control you.
Now, Leslie was really good last night. Hers was the only comment that I watched. She was really good at stringing together half-truths and making it sound like a plausible story. She pasted together that coffee story from 2 years ago, which was on the heels of the Drag Queen Bingo event. And then she tried to make it sound like she had reached out to me via an email. That email that she sent to me was in response to one that I had sent to her, trying to answer to the allegations in the library censure. So to paint that as something that she took the initiative to do and that I never responded was completely misleading. But
Bill,
most of her comments were misleading.
Bill, she has conservative friends she talks to all the time at the bus stop and other fictional places she goes with her conservative friends. They're very understanding. She is a woman for all in Downers Grove, according to her.
I'm not sure she represents all in Downers Grove. I think that was pretty clear last night. Leslie wants to run for mayor, which should frighten everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And this was likely a calculated political play for her to gain support from a portion of the community that she thinks gets very motivated by this kind of activity.
And the other three, you know, that present as, we're dispassionate business professionals who are here to serve our community. We don't have time for these partisan politics that are so bedeviling America these days, even though I've run for state rep and I'm involved in the Democratic Party and so on and so forth. What about those other three gentlemen?
Well, the two out of the three were no surprise. I mean, Greg Jose and Chris Gilmartin were also very offended by my stance on Drag Queen Bingo, and they've been grinding that axe for 2 years. The surprise was Mike Davenport, who ran as a pseudo-conservative, pseudo-Republican in the last election and completely abandoned those voters last night when he voted with the newly formed progressive bloc of the Downers Grove Village Council.
So what are you gonna do now?
Maybe get reappointed to the Economic Development Board, or
yeah.
I mean, you're not gonna give
I'm
up.
The, are you? No, definitely not. This is not going away. There's a number of issues we're following up on. There may be some legal challenges to this. Okay. You know, they added at the last minute wording to the resolution last night that said neglect of duty and misconduct, and they did that. Because somebody had made them aware that their motion as it stood was not in compliance with a state statute that had passed since the last time they railroaded a conservative off the library board. And so they added that language at the last minute. And I think they did that in ignorance of the legal standard that comes with the term misconduct and neglect of duty.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because we played Martin Tully's response to that. Martin Tully, who's a trustee and an attorney. And I thought his explanation of the threshold that misconduct and neglect of office require, you know, the threshold you have to clear to make that charge stick was very good. And, you know, based on his characterization of the evidence in support of that claim, sounds pretty thin. But I think one of the other things, you know, and the mayor said this. You know, I'm voting against this because basically to vote for it is to implicate ourselves since we have the appointment power. Well, that's true. So, so even though he voted with you, he sort of it was a little bit of Pontius Pilate from the dais with the mayor. And, I think people looking at the from the outside in, and maybe have some memories of Downers Grove once upon a time, what happened? What happened to Downers Grove question? How was you represented by, you know, Anna Stava Murray and Leslie Sadowski Fugit? And why is a mayor who otherwise comes across as sensible appointing these rabid political activists to the library board and allowing them to you know, silence or push out anybody who disagrees with them. I mean, we're sort of just like, what the hell's going on here?
Out with a lot of fire and brimstone, but Bob is a friend. I have nothing bad to say about him. He is dealing with a difficult situation, and Bob is by nature a consensus builder. Mm-hmm. So I think he's doing the best he can. You know, one of the problems we have, and the reason that he appointed or had to appoint somebody who is also not a conservative, is we had a board seat come up within the last year, and we were not able to find quality candidates, which is another sign of the almost incredible flip that's happened in Downers Grove and really DuPage County at large.
Right. You just don't have, I mean, they're just not there, or to the extent they're there, just not interested in engaging.
If you were a conservative and you watched what just happened to me, would you put your neck out there?
Right.
It's difficult when you see the effectiveness of the cancel culture machine and how quickly and efficiently they orchestrate things like this, which, by the way, Leslie was in cahoots with the library board members that drove this. She was not responding to their request. She was part of the development of the censure and actually surfaced her resolution before the censure had even passed, interestingly.
Yeah.
So we're trying to dig into that a little bit more. But
Of course there was skullduggery afoot. Standard operating procedure, right?
Yeah, but the transformation of Downers Grove and DuPage County is troubling, and we have to do a better job of recruiting people and getting people to step up and help out.
All right, so you're staying. You're not moving to Florida or Scottsdale or anything. You're going to stay. You're going to stick it out.
I would love to move to Florida or Scottsdale, but my wife's family's from here. We love our community. We love our church. We love our school and our friends and our kids' friends, and we're going to stick it out.
All right. Bill Nienberg, former, for now, library board trustee in Downers Grove.
I'm working on appointing myself as the new president of the library board of disc trustees, so maybe I'll come back and share some plans.
There you go. The shadow board. I like that. All right, Bill, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. You guys have a good day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Trump trial, day two, talking Manhattan, of course. As you mentioned, Amy, we've got seven jurors now seated in that trial. I didn't hear. Did you? How many of them are members of Biden's cabinet?
We don't know yet.
Uh-huh.
That didn't come out yet.
No, I see. Mm-hmm. And one of them celebrated Trump's loss on social media. But that juror is in.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of what you expected. I mean, again, if the thing is going to be wired by the prosecutor and the judge, you might as well wire up the jury, too. I mean, why leave anything to chance?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The Trump lawyers, just so you know, they weren't asleep at the switch, tried to prevent that juror from being seated. They wanted to have a peremptory challenge to excuse the juror. But the judge said, nope, she can be impartial. She stays. Of course, the conflicted judge says the prospective juror who celebrated Trump's 2020 loss can be impartial, just like he can be.
I mean, this is so rigged from the get-go. And all this is election interference. There's no there.
You know, the funny thing about that election interference piece, though, is, you know, the argument, Trump could be in Georgia and North Carolina and across the country. But you know what? I mean, all eyes are on Trump. So is it really election? I mean, I understand the argument and I'm sympathetic to it. But the flip side of this whole thing boomeranging, increasingly looking like it's going to boomerang on Biden Incorporated, is that all this does is focus everyone's attention on Trump You know, this is by the trial of the century kind of coverage, a la OJ. People are following this courtroom drama as it's unfolding and not much of anything else. Other than having to live their daily lives with people that are in their neighborhoods who are illegal, and you're paying for them and what you're paying at the pump and at the grocery store. I mean, those things aren't forgotten. But I mean, I don't know how this all redounds to Biden's benefit when Trump is out there as soon as they've adjourned for the day. Trump is visiting the bodega in New York where Jose Alba had to defend his life against a knife wielding thug and then was wrongly arrested and charged with murder. I mean, sort of he was Daniel Penny before Daniel Penny, and it allows Trump to highlight what's going on in major cities run by Democrats, as he did.
Yeah, now they believe. I heard 78% think it's a rigged deal. And it is a rigged deal. It's a rigged trial. Our courts, everything is screwed up in New York. And the whole world is watching. This judge is so conflicted. You understand that. You'll take a look at that. There's never been a judge so conflicted as this. It's ridiculous. And also, there's no crime. You know where the crime is? In the bodegas, where they come and rob them every week. Or more than that. This is all politics. This is coming out of the White House. And, you know, it makes me campaign locally, and that's okay. That's not it. Well, I don't think so. You know what? I don't think so. I think we're doing better, Brian. We're doing better now than we've ever done. So I think it's having a reverse effect. You know what? All I want is fairness. And these people have to be treated better. The Bodega Association, bodegas, because every week they're being robbed 2-3 times. It's crazy. It's crazy. And you know what? The police can do it. They can stop it. But they have to be allowed to do their job.
So now he's got a twofer. He's got the rigged system, the system that's rigged against me, but it's really rigged against you. And they're just coming after me to get to you. Don't forget that. And, oh, by the way, the lawlessness that has been inflicted upon metropolitan areas around this country by decarceration, deprosecution, defund the police, open borders, Democrats.
Well, what I'm concerned about, I mean, he made a remark about the judge and now Alvin Bragg, the prosecutor. He wants him put in jail for 30 days because of, you know, comments that he made and also on social media about Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen.
Sleazebags.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Please put Trump in jail for 30 days. See
right.
how that works out.
Right.
Do it. I beg you to.
It's going to be like they're going to be outside the jail like Crazy Nelson Joe does. Clark.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what it's going to be. Joe, you got to go out there and calm the crowd down.
But it does. I mean, I this is fine for the first week of the trial, but it eventually, I think it's going to get old, and he does need to be out there. And Trump knows that he needs to be out in swing states.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House because the guy can't put two sentences together. He can't campaign. They're using this in order to try and win an election.
Yeah, and he'll do rallies on the weekends, and that's all he needs to do, really.
Right, so no golf for a while.
You know, it's interesting, too. I mean, so how is this going? Trump, you heard Trump reference, oh, it's going better than it's, we're doing better than we've ever done. Well, again, more polling that is pretty encouraging, should be for Trump supporters and certainly is for the former president, as you heard. Now, again, snapshots in time, long way to go, all the caveats, but this survey of 1,059 registered voters by New York Times Siena, mostly good for America, 25%. Mostly good for America, Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, how has Joe Biden's administration been? 25% say mostly good for America, 46% say mostly bad. Donald Trump, 42% say mostly good, 33% say mostly bad. So Joe Biden is underwater by 21 points, and Donald Trump is plus 9. And, oh, by the way, the Leslie Sadowski Fugit on MSNBC, her name's Joy Reid, Or maybe Leslie Sadowski-Fugit is the Downers Grove version of Joy Reid. I'm not sure. You can go either way with it, I suppose. This is Joy Reid's perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, you want to run this race hustle? You want to run this virulent identitarian rap? Go ahead. Go ahead. Joy Reid, here's somebody else doing Trump a favor, and she doesn't know it.
There is something wonderfully poetic about the fact that despite the fact that even if convicted, he's not going to go to prison, the first person to actually criminally prosecute Donald Trump is a black Harvard grad, the very kind of person that his former staff, the people who worked for him, Stephen Miller, et cetera, want to never be at Harvard Law School. But he was. And he came out and graduated. He's prosecuting you, Donald. And a black woman is doing that same exact thing in Georgia. And a black woman forced you to pay a $175 million fine that's out now also in question because the people who put it up, that might not be legit. Donald Trump is being held to account by the very multicultural, multiracial democracy that he's trying to dismantle. And for me, there's something poetic and actually wonderful about that. It says something good about our country that we're still capable of having that happen. Go DEI. My DEIs are bringing it home on today.
My DEIs are bringing it home?
Yeah.
Go team.
My DEIs are bringing it home. That's the kind of America you want to live in? The substance of a particular criminal proceeding doesn't matter. What matters is the identity of the prosecutor, the identity of the defendant. That's what matters.
Black female. Mm-hmm. That's what matters to her.
My DEIs are bringing it home.
Really? Fannie Willis is really bringing it home? I think she kind of stepped in it, besides wearing her dress on backwards.
That's Joy Reid's America. That's Leslie Sadowski-Fugit's America. Is it yours? Well, if it's not, you better put up a bit of a fight for it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, Mike, Northwest Indiana.
Good morning, guys. I think they're saving President Trump a ton in campaign finance money. Doesn't have to spend. You get Biden's campaigns. We had 75 sycophants show up, and most are on the government payroll or the hardcore Democrats. The Democratic Party is going to get barbecued beyond their wildest imaginations this November. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mike.
Joe Biden yesterday, because he can go out and campaign, and he was Scranton Joe, claiming victory over Trump for some reason.
He learned that paying taxes was something people who work for a living did, not him. He learned that telling people you're fired was something to laugh about. Listen to what he says. He says, quote, I'll be dictator on day one. Quote, I am your retribution. He promises, quote, a bloodbath if he loses. I wake every morning thinking about how to make life better like you do for working and middle-class families here in Scranton and all across the country.
I mean, nobody was even there. I mean, I don't know if they had to pay people to show up, but he's not the it girl.
Ron, Southside.
Dan and Amy, Joy Reid is a blithering idiot.
And a Harvard grad. Those two things are increasingly synonymous, not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely, but guess what? We will see in November. Chomp it up. Have a good day.
All right, Ron. Thanks for the call. Robert, Bloomingdale.
You know, this is disgusting stuff. My question is, from a legal standpoint, is why couldn't Team Trump take this demand that this judge recuse himself and take the case to another state where Trump would probably get a fair trial and eventually it would be thrown out? What do you think?
Motion for the judge to recuse himself, denied. Motion for change of venue, denied. Grounds for an appeal if he's convicted. But that's how it works. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, a couple more comments on the Trump trial in its infancy. But as we were talking about, 7 jurors have been seated by the hopelessly conflicted judge. mention, right? We mentioned the one juror who celebrated Trump's 2020 loss, but was seated anyway.
How did they let that happen?
They let that happen. Well, they objected, and the judge says, no, she can be impartial, or the juror. I don't know if it's a she. The juror can be impartial, so it's all good. And don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Sorry, judge.
Okay. Mayor Adams, Eric Adams, has chimed in on this. He's given us his assurance.
In your city will be fair to former President Trump.
The city is a fair city, and that's why they're on the jury duty. Both sides is tied, and they interview and make the determination.
Well, it's a fair city. So
nothing to see here, folks. Don't
worry. You're pretty little
my
ads.
Reputation, yes.
Yeah. I'm sure Brandon Johnson would say the same thing about Chicago, and they would be he would be equally wrong. Also, we're getting a lot of opinions on this. And Jen
let it cook. Dude. Come on.
Becky. She's got a show on MSNBC you probably don't know because
nobody watches it.
Yeah, we're basically the only people who have to watch it. She got noted legal scholar John Legend to weigh in on the Trump Trump trial.
Come on.
Mm-hmm.
That's slow of a news day.
John Legend is giving all of him. See what I did there? All of me, you know.
Just don't
hit.
Start singing it, please.
No, I don't have the range of a John Legend, but I do have a keener legal mind, as does everybody else listening. John Legend, an in-depth discussion about our legal system with Jen Psaki said this.
Well, he is a part of a two-tier system of justice, but not in the way that he thinks he is. Mm-hmm. He is getting way more concessions than the average criminal defendant would get. He's getting delays. He's got access to all kinds of lawyers that are filing this and filing that, delaying every trial. And most people don't have access to that kind of lawyering, don't have access to the kind of concessions that the justice system will provide to you if you can afford it.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the favorite lines of the left, too. We've been hearing this for a while, is this special treatment that Trump is getting because his lawyers are filing motions in the various cases and so forth. Well, first of all, if he wasn't running for president, he wouldn't be on trial in any of these jurisdictions.
Right, exactly. And that's what you have to keep in mind. It's the fact that he's running again and they couldn't beat him. Or they don't think they can beat him at the ballot box, so now they're going after him with these, you know, frivolous criminal and civil cases.
And secondly, there's been some good write-ups on this. Don't have time to get into detail now. But if anything, when it comes to particularly the federal trials, federal cases, Trump is not being afforded the same courtesies, not just courtesies, but the actual standard time frames for motions and filings and responses as any other federal defendant, federal criminal defendant. So he is not getting special treatment. He's getting special treatment, but not in the way John Legend thinks. He's getting special treatment because he's been targeted for elimination by the justice system at the federal and some of the state levels. That's the special treatment.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. An underreported aspect of the present situation in the Middle East, against the backdrop of the Iranian attack on Israel over the weekend, and the backdrop of Democrats like Elizabeth Warren running around accusing Israel of genocide, not to mention whatever anti-Semitic drivel is coming out of the mouths of the socialist spice girls like Tlaib and Omar and AOC. And the Biden administration's chastisement of Netanyahu specifically to try to score points with a constituency he needs in Michigan come November. Something that has been lost in all of that is for all the calls for ceasefire and all the criticisms of Israel, it's the Iranian-backed Hamas terrorist organization that is rejecting any ceasefire deal.
Yeah,
in point
forget,
of fact,
I'm sorry, people forget about that, but that is a fact.
Well, in point of fact, where it's at now, and this is according to Biden's State Department, Hamas is the barrier and obstacle to a ceasefire in Gaza. Matthew Miller said that. Hamas is demanding a six-week truce in which it releases no hostages while Israel stops fighting, withdraws from Gaza's cities, and commits to a permanent ceasefire, a withdrawal from Gaza, and the return of all Palestinians, including Hamas, to northern Gaza. In other words, they want Israel to surrender. That's reasonable. That's likely. No. Only in the second phase, over a subsequent 6 weeks, while Israel executes that surrender, would Hamas release some hostages in exchange for terrorist prisoners. Right. Who wants to sign up for that deal? Certainly not the Israelis, whatever the war council's infighting is there. That's just absurd. But that absurdity is being underreported. Something else, too, I was just thinking about this over the weekend with the Iranian attack. Failed, thankfully, as it did.
Yeah.
And some of the characterizations of it. The conversation about how this regime, the first two terms under Obama and this third term under Biden, has underwritten Iran's terrorist activities is just, it just has to be emphasized. I mean, in the most positive light possible, it is one of the worst foreign policy blunders in the history of this country, in my view. And in something less charitable, it's borderline traitorous, particularly the continuation of it. Even as you have the Secretary of State and others say, yeah, Iran uses money to sponsor terror. That's what the mullahs in Tehran do. Right. And so we're unfreezing assets. Why?
Well, they said they're going to monitor the assets that they release.
5 minutes ago, they were a partner in peace to a nuclear deal. Partner in peace in the Middle East. Right. But it reminded me of the 60 Minutes piece last year about the Iranians' sponsor of terrorist activities in this country, assassination squads, actually, targeting U.S. officials, including officials in the Trump administration, including John Bolton.
Oh, that's right. Was posted online by a channel affiliated with Iran's Revolutionary Guard. It vows to kill former American government officials, including President Trump, to avenge the 2020 U.S. assassination of the terrorism mastermind Qasem Soleimani. Threats like this have been deemed credible enough that several of these officials have been under round-the-clock protection, including former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Iran reportedly offered a hitman $1 million to kill him, and John Bolton, the former national security advisor.
They bargained the price for me would be $300,000, which I have to say I found insulting.
So what exactly was the plot against you?
The Revolutionary Guard sought to procure either my kidnapping or my assassination. Not directly by a Revolutionary Guards member, but by seeking a hitman who would carry out the job either in the U.S. or abroad.
The FBI has an arrest warrant out for this Iranian officer claiming that he hired the hitman online to travel to Washington, corner Bolton in a garage, and kill him. But it turned out, lucky for Bolton, the assassin was an FBI informant.
This was not internet chatter. This was a negotiation to murder an American citizen, a former government official.
Is the threat against you ongoing?
We've got marked Secret Service cars that say police, United States Secret Service, outside my home.
Also, regular Iranian citizens, dissidents, who fled Iran under threat of death and work against the totalitarian regime there. One such woman who was profiled was Masih Ahmadinejad. She was included in the 60 Minutes piece.
It's like, wow, the government from my own country trying to kill me, but my adopted country trying to protect me. You have to be an Iranian to survive assassination plot to understand that how it feels to survive in America and to have the platform and to criticize the U.S. government.
You're tearing up. Tell me why you're tearing up.
Because people in my country get killed for criticizing, get shot in head for the crime of criticizing.
And what do we see at the airports and bridges and college campuses? Death to America. Real persuasive. Real intelligent. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Arash Azizi. He's a senior lecturer in history and political science at Clemson University, contributing writer for The Atlantic and author of What Iranians Want, Women, Life, and Freedom. Arash Azizi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. It's great to be with you.
The piece you wrote, Ordinary Americans Don't Want a War with Israel, Ordinary Iranians Don't Want a War with Israel, that is. I think most people would stipulate to that, but how are we supposed to receive that in terms of thinking about our response to the Iranian government?
It's a good question. The United States and Western countries have, you know, for a long time, haven't really had a coherent policy to deal with Iran and the Iranian government. And, it's not an easy question to have a coherent policy on. The Iranian regime is a malign actor, and is a very tough malign actor. It's hard. But I mean, as to what can be done, my position has always been that there should be support for Iranian people and their quest for democracy, and there are a variety of ways that support can be given. But attacking Iran or war or even the kind of, you know, aggressive sanctions don't necessarily work, as they haven't. I heard your piece before this, so I'm sure we will disagree on a lot of stuff. But look, I'll tell you this. Leaving the Iranian nuclear deal in 2018 by President Trump gave power and empowered the most hardline elements inside Iran. And, you know, we can rehash it different ways. Anyways, today is a, you know, different time. But I'll say this. Whatever this conversation is, and we can have it, it's not very straightforward. If it was just an easy task of you're just a tough guy and you do something for the Iranian regime to disappear or get overthrown, I'll be the first one to support it. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work like that.
Well, how did it empower people when Trump got out of the deal in 2018?
Well, because there was a faction in the regime that had made the Iran deal of 2015 and that had wanted to better its ties with the United States and the West. This faction had the support of the majority of Iranians that voted for them. Look, we didn't think they were good guys, right? But they wanted better relations with the West. They opposed Iran's policy in the region. They opposed the dominance of this anti-Israel militia, IRGC, in Iranian politics. And after Trump left, they were severely weakened because that was their only policy, signature achievement. Look, we can't do counterfactual history. I'm not saying if Trump hadn't left Khamenei, we have necessarily Khamenei, that is the supreme leader in Iran, who is the root of all of our problems, mm-hmm. he would have necessarily been weakened. I don't know, but I don't think it helped. And I'll tell you something else. The Islamic Republic wouldn't have as advanced a nuclear program now that it does now. So, and you know, this is, as I said, it's not so much revenge to pass. It's to say that I'll tell you this. You know, in the United States, if we honestly try to look, tons of different people in different administrations have really done with good intentions often try to do something against this regime. And I think it's bad for U.S. discourse when you call your own president and patriotic people serving this government as traitors and supporters of Iran just because they adopted a slightly different path of the most diplomacy. And anybody who works with this, any of those who are Iran experts like me, we've talked to people, there really is no easy solution to this thing. Because Iran is a malign and tough actor.
Well, here's the thing about that. I mean, I'm not saying there's an easy solution, and but I am saying you start with first principles, and you, to me, I mean, this is just sort of baseline common sense. You don't suggest that a country is the lead state sponsor of terror in the world, which is a phrase that is almost always associated with Iran, including by this administration, and turn around and underwrite them with, when you include the oil profits that they've generated thanks to our energy policy under this administration over the last decade, is probably getting upwards of $400 billion. See, to me, that doesn't make sense. So we can talk about how you you try to aid moderate elements. We can support the college kids on the streets as we did during the Green Revolution. All that's fine. But
during the Green Revolution, the United States did very little.
We could have done more. I'm all for supporting any peaceful pluralist movements in Iran, but I am not for the folly of underwriting the mullahs in Tehran and suggesting, oh, no, we're monitoring this, or these are segregated funds only for humanitarian. Give me a break. And so what's the money they're using to finance the Houthis in Yemen and Hezbollah and Hamas and the Islamic Jihad? I mean, come on.
Let me tell you where the money is. Look, this is a misconception. Iran is a country of 90 million. It has ties with China and Russia and North Korea and other countries in the world. Look, unfortunately or not, it's a good free market world. The countries don't care. They don't always care with the. So there's nothing that the United States can do that will, there is, of course, we can talk about it, right? But it's very little that no matter what the United States does, Iran will always have access to millions of dollars to fund these groups. After all, during the 4 years of Trump administration, did Iran do less any of this stuff?
No, but
it was when Iran attacked Saudi Arabia, and the United States did nothing.
I understand rogue states are going to do what rogue states do, but it doesn't mean we have to be party to financing them. That's pretty straightforward.
Well, but I mean, it's not a matter of course, you know, it's the U.S. is not financing Iran, right? It's what it was doing under the Iran deal. But return to some, it's a pretty big, significant achievement of getting rid of its nuclear program. It gave some concessions to it. Iran was still the most, it still is the most sanctioned country. So sure, Biden could, if you support the sanctions, you can say Biden could do more on enforcing the oil sanctions. But Biden has also maintained the sort of channels with Iran and has used it for other purposes. It's a dangerous situation. But all I'm saying is, there can be a policy debate, but you know, I can assure you, I know people in the State Department and others who are working on this, they are worried as much about the threat of Iran as any other person. And it's not like they're dupes or haven't thought of this, you know.
I don't know about that. But I know that the House just voted 383-11 to expand sanctions against Chinese financial institutions that buy Iranian oil. So we'll see if the administration signs on to that overwhelmingly bipartisan measure. So, I mean, these sanctions can be both direct and indirect to further punish Iran, a punishment it richly deserves, the regime richly deserves, whether the people do or not. I mean, that's how it works when you're trying to tackle a totalitarian regime, as you know, saying, I mean, you said it at the outset, this is complicated, and there are some tools that we have and can use, and there is collateral damage, but we also can't sit idly by. Not to mention, given the domestic terrorist activities that 60 Minutes, not exactly a conservative outlet, documented too. So, I mean, yes, it's one malign actor. It's a big one, and we were reminded of just how big it was with the effort they made over this weekend to inflict more carnage on Israel. And I wonder how you see that attack, because some have suggested, like those folks over at The Intercept, that that wasn't really an effort, despite what you heard from Biden administration officials to inflict maximum carnage. It didn't make Iran weaker and Israel stronger, the failure of the drones and the missiles to get through the Iron Dome, that this was just a show. This was a shot across the bow. So how should we understand what happened over the weekend, that attempted attack?
You know, it's the tough one, and there, you know, people who have real intelligence, you know, will have to sort of talk about that as well. But here's my assessment. I mean, I think the Iranian regime didn't want a direct confrontation with Israel because it knows that would be suicidal. At the same time, I think it didn't expect all the missiles and drones that it fired to have so little of an effect. So I guess I'm a bit of a middling position. I mean, I do think they didn't really want to go kill a lot of people or do something like that because they knew that would be suicidal for them, right? Can you imagine if, I don't know, 30 Israeli civilians had been killed, Israel would probably have to respond immediately and the regime couldn't have taken it. So I don't think they want a war because I think Khamenei is quite a smart and he knows that he takes his time and, you know, he has done this sort of over a long period. It's what he calls a strategic patience. So I don't think it was a change from that. It was kind of the answers we expected, but I do think it was. It does show number one, it shows Israel has the support of the West and even its neighboring country Jordan, and you know, if you believe to some reports, some other Arab countries, it has potential support, and that it's, you know, it was thankfully able to defeat these attempts by Iran. And you know what Amos Harel, the military correspondent over at Haaretz in the Israeli newspaper, said was that this really shows that the axis of resistance, this group of anti-Israel groups supported by Iran, what is their main weapon? It's drones and missiles. And this attack shows that they probably have very limited, you know, they have relatively limited use. Well, of course, it's a different question if Hezbollah also attacked in the north at the same time. And, you know, there could be that. But Israel did pretty well.
Well, Israel has not. They are going to retaliate. We don't know when. We don't know how. What do you think would be appropriate?
As to what would be appropriate, it's not just what I think, but, you know, what the United States and most other countries have been calling on Israel. In fact, if you read the columnists, basically those who are on the right, those who are on the left, it's very clear that a possibility of escalation of a direct war between Iran and Israel is a pretty catastrophic one. It would be terrible for the region, it would be terrible for the people of Iran, terrible for the people of Israel, it would be pretty much terrible for everyone involved. And, you know, as I said, New York Times, Bret Stephens, or Thomas Friedman, they look at the issue very differently, but they all end up with the same sort of advice at the end for Israel, is that they won, effectively, on April 13th, and whatever retaliation they have to do, and I agree with you that they've decided to do, and you know, they'll have to do something, but they should really work hard to avoid a broader conflagration and a new war, if you will, that Israel can't afford, and the region can't afford, really, and the world can't afford. It would have catastrophic consequences for everyone.
Well, I don't know if this would be termed an escalation or just mission fulfillment. But what is your view then on Israel ending this as quickly as possible by means of attempting to root out Hamas in one of its apparent last safe havens, that's Rafah, because until there is a belief that Hamas has been severely crippled such that something like October 7th is never going to happen again, this will persist. So isn't it in everybody's interest for Israel to strike a final blow against Hamas as quickly as possible?
No, because there is, you know, it's not a video game.
I'm not saying it's a video game.
Well, it's not, there's not, but it sounds like it when you say it that way. No, an invasion of Rafah, which people with, you know, look, I'm sorry to say that, bring serious military correspondents from Israel and, you know, ask them what they think about the possibility of this. Hamas is a political party and a political movement with tens of thousands of supporters amongst Palestinians. Whether you like it or not, you can imagine that, of course I don't. But you cannot destroy a movement like that by killing tens of thousands of people, you know, as Israel has. And, you know, it's not a a group like that, isn't it? It's not a terror group like Al-Qaeda that is hiding in some cave. If you kill everyone in Gaza, there are other people in the West Bank who belong to Hamas and who belong to other terror groups. And you know why they will belong to other terror groups? I'll answer you by Ehud Barak, Israel's most decorated military leader, former prime minister, said. He said, if I was a young Palestinian, I would probably join one of the terror groups. Because that's the reality. Palestinians have lived for decades under occupation. And that is what it needs to end. That is what needs to end in order for this problem to finish. Sorry, go on.
So we're going to go back to just everybody puts down their arms and we go through this two-state solution charade. I mean, there's no appetite for that.
Why is it a charade?
Because there's no appetite for whom?
Who said that?
First, in Chicago,
it doesn't offend you. There is appetite for a lot of people in the Middle East, and there's definitely appetite for a lot of people in Israel if they can see that it's possible. Look, here's the thing. This is why the far right and the far left will say the same thing. Yes, it's a very common talking point to say that two-state solution is impossible. You know, there's no
Right now. I mean, if you're the point is with an eye towards ending the hostilities. And what I'm saying is right now, that is years ago. Maybe even just a few years ago when Abraham Accords were being signed, maybe that was more realistic. But right now, it's not particularly realistic politically. You know, what's politically feasible? What's possible? So if that's not possible in the short term right now and you want to try to end hostilities, then what's the path?
I think, first of all, I mean, you spoke about Hamas rejecting the deal for releasing the hostages. That is true. There should be an attempt to get a deal to release the hostages. And to end this, and to bring about a ceasefire, and to have a plan. You say that it's not right now possible. Sure, it's not possible right now. Of course, you know, I didn't think it was possible like in 6 months or something. But there should be an attempt to try to think of the day after. So Israel has done this war now. What is the day after for people in Gaza and people in the West Bank? Unfortunately, it's quite terrible now. These fascist parties that are part of Netanyahu's government are running amok in West Bank. I think from the perspective of Israeli national interest, it's very necessary to have a plan for the day after. And you're not going to be able, you know, you say, oh, invasion of Rafah. Well, as I say, you cannot militarily take out Hamas so easily. Because it's a political movement that includes tons of people. It has been degraded as much as you can. The atrocities of October 7 are a historical crime whose responsibility shares by Hamas, of course, and by the Iranian regime, who, even though they didn't know that was happening on that day, they had armed and funded Hamas for years. There's no doubt about that. But the best revenge against it is attempts to really bring an end to this conflict. Unfortunately, I don't think Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has the best interest of his people in mind. And it's not, you know, just what I think. It's what tons of people in Israel believe. He is a self-serving guy who is not serving his people well. And if Israel goes to elections anytime soon, the people will definitely elect a different leader. And I hope it will enact different policies that will bring peace for the people of Israel and for everybody in the region.
Arash Azizi, senior lecturer in history and poli-sci at Clemson University, contributing writer for The Atlantic, and author of What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. Arash Azizi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So NPR's got a new boss, just like the old boss, same as the old boss, and the earth just keeps on spinning. And NPR keeps on pumping out propaganda subsidized by me and you and all American taxpayers. Uri Berliner, senior editor for NPR, does business news. You know, did this podcast with Barry Weiss over at the Free Press last week and wrote an op-ed talking about NPR's lack of journalistic integrity, frankly, and there's no other way to describe it. Their reliance on mainly Adam Schiff to cover the Russian collusion allegations that bedeviled Trump for the first 2 years of his administration and turned out to be false. And nary a mea culpa was offered by NPR. Mm-hmm. The Hunter Biden laptop story, which they were dutiful in their contributions to its suppression prior to the 2020 election, and just other such examples where NPR is not a journalistic enterprise. It is the comm shop for the state that finances the state that finances it, you know, depending on who's in charge, as long as their fellow travelers are in charge.
Yeah, he basically said that the DNC is the, I'm sorry, NPR is the DNC in disguise.
I got so frustrated with what I saw was the sort of the lack of different perspectives in our coverage. What I found was 87 registered Democrats on our editorial staff, 0 Republicans. Something's gone wrong here. Where, you know, if we're really thinking about diversity and our coverage, the response was it wasn't like wow, it wasn't like we're going to change this or try and address this somehow. It was just more like, wow, that's weird.
Upon the announcement of NPR's new CEO, Catherine Maher, he said, "We're looking for a leader right now who's going to be unifying and bring more people into the tent and have broader perspective on sort of what America's all about. And this seems to be the opposite of that, Ms. Maher." Oh, she's the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. There's no question that she's the opposite of that, as all these tweets of hers that have been unearthed and are in circulation now would indicate. For his moments of candor, Mr. Berliner has now been suspended by NPR. I mean, they just can't help themselves. So, suppression and opposing viewpoints, and sidelining opposing viewpoints. That's the problem at NPR. Somebody calls attention to it, they get suspended. Do you understand the irony of no? They don't, and they don't care. And none other than Jonathan Turley raised an issue that, frankly, congressional Republicans should be raising. It's been raised before. It's been raised before for decades. But Republicans never do anything about it, to their discredit.
To simply confirm what all of us knew, that the that NPR has become unrelentingly partisan, and they've engaged in this type of advocacy journalism. But at the end of the day, Martha, it doesn't matter what the slant is or whether it's slanted. We need to have a discussion in this country about state-funded media. You know, this NPR is indistinguishable from media outlets like MSNBC or CNN, but they don't receive these subsidies. The question is why the United States, every taxpayer, should subsidize NPR. You know, the NPR audience is overwhelmingly wealthy, are certainly better off than most Americans. They're overwhelmingly white, and they're overwhelmingly liberal, about 70%. Identify themselves as liberals, and yet they expect every taxpayer to support them. So the question is, as a country, is this really what we want to do? Do we want the government funding particular media platforms over others?
Yeah, we know there's been a lot of push.
NPR's new CEO, this Catherine Maher, just to give you a little flavor.
Real hoot.
"I know that hysteric white women voice. I was taught to do it. I've done it. It's a disturbing recognition. While I don't recall ever using it to deliberately expose another person to immediate physical harm on my own cognizance, it's not impossible. That is whiteness. Huh? And I'm white, so my hair doesn't automatically carry with it the freight of my race, worth, and everyone else's encoded assumptions and biases. I mean, sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protests not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property. Lots of jokes about leaving the U.S., and I get it, but as someone with a cis white mobility privilege, I'm thinking I'm staying and investing in ridding ourselves of this specter of tyranny. Of course, the specter of tyranny is Trump. So you can expect him to get a fair shake throughout the next 6 months and into his second term. I mean, yeah, this is what Uri Berliner is talking about when he says, this selection for CEO seems to be the opposite of what NPR needs. Yeah, you know, it's the opposite.
And she went, when she put in her statement about his, you know, suspension, she wrote, NPR is independent, beholden to no party, and without commercial interests. Oh, really?
Right. It's beholden to no party. It's beholden to a specific ideology that is most closely affiliated with the New Marxist Party. Beholden to identitarianism, which is the New Marxism practiced by the New Marxist Party, which used to be called the Democrat Party. But nice try, Catherine.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I think it's time we stopped funding NPR, don't you?
Long past time.
Yes.
Long past time. And it's also, too, this it's long past time that there is more full-throated defenses for free speech and a free press. And this is something that some on the left once upon a time believed in, and they don't now. They're a censorious group, Catherine Maher among them, clearly. And, you know, you may want to swivel your head and look around the Western world, because it's getting pretty dicey when it comes to free expression. It's not just for the usual totalitarian suspects anymore. You had the NatCon, National Conservatism Conference in Brussels, shut down.
Oh, that's right.
That was shut down. I saw Rod Dreher posting about it because Nigel Farage was going to speak and some others, and the mayor there of the community in Brussels. We had to close that down, the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels, because it was creating a public disturbance. Police gave attendees 15 minutes to exit the venue. Mm-hmm. So that's in Belgium. Oh, that's where the world headquarters of the EU, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah.
That's central office EU in Brussels. Mm-hmm. Yeah, epicenter of power in Europe. Shutting down a conservative conference because a British politician was going to speak, you know, and some other conservatives. Oh, heavens. In Brazil, we've been talking about the Twitter files of Brazil and what's going on there. It's getting pretty chippy, according to Michael Schellenberger, who's on the ground there. He tweeted out a couple of days ago, Brazil should terrify you. He said that after that Supreme Court justice moved to threaten to shut down Twitter,
mm-hmm,
if Musk didn't abide their censorship directives, he said it seemed like things were calming after newspapers editorialized against censorship. The head of the Brazilian Bar Association gave a strong statement in support of freedom of speech. And the president of Brazil's Supreme Court said the conflict between Brazil and X, Twitter, was just a big game. People talking a big game. But he said that changed. Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, Lula, as they call him, this is the guy that ousted Bolsonaro with, arguably, it has been argued, the help of our deep state agencies. Lula is proposed that the government has the power to arrest anyone for lying. He was going to criminalize lying. Mm. And who is the eye of the beholder on who's telling the truth and who's lying? The government. Schellenberger writing about this. Thousands of Workers' Party activists took to X yesterday to demand that that he, Schellenberger, be arrested for things he said during his testimony before the Brazilian Senate. And under Lula's criminalization of lying, he potentially could be. The head of X in Brazil announced they quit for fear of safety. He writes to Schellenberger, I'm not afraid for myself. I fear neither the devil nor de Moraes, the Supreme Court justice, rapidly turning himself into Brazil's dictator. I'm taking all necessary precautions to ensure that I can leave Brazil safely and without being arrested. You can help by sharing this video and spreading the word about what's happening here. And yet, what's happening in Brazil terrifies me nonetheless. I love this country and its people and fear that it's on the cusp of totalitarianism. A significant share of the left wants to incarcerate their political enemies. Sound familiar? Respected Brazilian journalists say with a straight face that the government must engage in mass censorship in order to protect democracy. Brazil is everything George Orwell feared and worse. I would be less worried if Brazil were small and irrelevant, but it's not. Brazil, of course, is the largest and most important nation in Latin America. Just this week, top Brazilian government representatives were in China talking about how China is a model for Brazil. Brazil is an inspiration for European totalitarians who have weaponized government intel agencies to spread disinformation about their political enemies and are implementing a censorship system to control the entire internet. This is Gestapo stuff here. This is serious business. Schellenberger's right. Word is that Musk is capitulating. Right? That Musk is going to abide the Brazilian that Brazilian Supreme Court judge, even though he called him a brutal dictator. The social X informed Brazil's Supreme Federal Tribunal and this de Moraes guy in a letter that it would not challenge a long list of censorship demands issued this month. That's Reuters reporting it on Monday. So that's a significant change in position because basically, as Musk sort of predicted, he was on the cusp of having his operation in Brazil shuttered by the government. I think you want to take judicial notice of these developments. And this is another real point of distinction between free minds and free markets oriented conservatives and the fascistic, since they love that term so much.
Yeah, I had fascistic last night too.
Fascistic left. And that's what fascism is, by the way. State subordination of all private institutions. All things run through the state. That's a leftist philosophy. And you're seeing it in action all over the West, including in this country, including in Downers Grove, since we kicked off the show with that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Fisher case before the high court, oral arguments. This is related to 1512C2 of Sarbanes-Oxley, the official or the criminal interruption of a official proceeding. That is the statute that federal prosecutors have used against many of the January 6th defendants and President Trump. So this is an important case. This exchange between Justice Neil Gorsuch and representing the Biden administration is Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogore. This exchange is important, and we want to get our next guest to weigh in on it, since we have one of the most brilliant legal minds joining us, Richard Epstein, momentarily. Take a listen to Gorsuch's challenge to the application of this federal statute to J6 defendants and by extension, President Trump.
If I might, so what does that mean for the breadth of this statute? Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
There are multiple elements of the statute that I think might not be satisfied by those hypotheticals, and it relates to the point I was going to make to the Chief Justice about the breadth of this statute. The kind of built-in limitations are the things that I think would potentially suggest that many of those things wouldn't be something the government could charge or prove as 1512C2 beyond a reasonable doubt, would include the fact that the actus reus does require obstruction, which we understand to be a meaningful interference. So that means that if you have some minor disruption or delay or some minimal outburst,
okay,
we don't think it falls within the actus reus.
My outbursts
to begin with
require the court to reconvene after the proceeding has been brought back into line, or the pulling of the fire alarm, the vote has to be rescheduled, or the protest outside of a courthouse makes it inaccessible for a period of time. Are those all federal felonies subject to 20 years in prison?
So with some of them, it would be necessary to show nexus. So with respect to the protest outside
assume,
the courthouse, we'd
can,
have to show
think,
that, yes, they were aiming
I've
at
shown,
the proceeding.
Yeah, they were trying to stop the proceeding.
Yes, and then we'd also have to be able to prove that they acted corruptly. And this sets a stringent mens rea. It's not even just the mere intent to obstruct. We have to show that also. But we have to show that they had corrupt intent in acting in that way.
We
and
went around that tree yesterday.
I know. I heard the argument yesterday. But I guess what I would say is that to the extent that your hypotheticals are pressing on the idea of a peaceful protest, even one that's quite disruptive, it's not clear to me that the government would be able to show that each of those protesters had corrupt intent.
So mostly peaceful protest that actually obstructs and impedes an official proceeding for an indefinite period would not be covered?
Not necessarily. We would just have to have the evidence of intent. And that's a high bar.
They intend to do it all right.
Yeah, they intend to do it all right. So when Jamal Bowman pulled that fire alarm and Congress had to be evacuated, he intended to do it. He didn't confuse it with the door handle or whatever nonsense he came up with. And so the vote had to be rescheduled. That's the example, one of the examples that Gorsuch is referring to. Sit-ins at the trial. Sit-ins at a trial. So the Kavanaugh protests, disrupting a nomination hearing. Hecklers in the crowd. Think of all the pro-Hamas protesters disrupting all kinds of events, canceling all kinds of events.
Oh, yeah.
The BLM protests disrupting, canceling events. So this corrupt intent. Well, I would have also challenged her. So give me an example where something like the examples I provided occurs where there wasn't corrupt intent, meaning intent to disrupt, intent to prevent. What was it? What was it otherwise in all of these actual real world incidents? And so distinguish that from those charged with federal crimes under this provision of federal statute that are facing 20 years in prison when they want for wandering through the Capitol. Some not even in the Capitol, on the grounds. And did otherwise not commit a violent act. It'll be very interesting to see how 1512 survives or doesn't when the court renders its opinion on this. For more on this and other matters, we are going to talk about the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park as well. And by the way, but before we bring Professor Epstein on, I just want you to think about this. You're about to hear from Professor Richard Epstein. Mm-hmm. He turns 81 years old today.
I know. It's his birthday, and we love birthdays here at AM 560.
Please don't sing. And Joe Biden is also 81 years old. So think about Joe Biden at 81 and Richard Epstein at 81, and just enjoy the distinction. I'll just say that. Professor Richard Epstein is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Happy birthday.
Thank you for the happy birthday. As you get older, each year becomes more precious.
Well, we're glad you're spending your time with us today.
Yes, yes.
It's a birthday.
Right. You can, you know, you can have a birthday cocktail after this interview. So that exchange with Gorsuch and the federal government's lawyer on 1512, with the implications it has on so many of these J6 cases and potentially Trump's cases as well. Give us your read on that exchange.
Well, my view about this from the beginning has been they've always charged things far too heavily because they're largely political trials. And every time you hear Alvin Bragg or Letitia James or even Merrick Garland say, we follow the law, just the law and only the law, you know that they're doing precisely the opposite. It's ridiculous to take financial situations where you're trying to build people millions of dollars and apply it to situations where the other statutes, which are directly applicable, having to do with entry, which is unlawful or impermissible, have much more restrictions in terms of the proof of the liability and, in fact, much lower sanctions. So I regard this as utterly irresponsible. A prosecutor on a case of this moment has to be very sure of their legal theories. And what they're doing in this case is pushing it as far and as hard as they possibly can. And what they say is, what do we have to lose, is their attitude. We go for this stuff. We want to get 20 years in prison for 4 minutes walking inside the building. We're going to basically take every ambiguous effort with respect to the use of force, never knowing who pushed whom when, and put it up to 20 years. This is utterly unforgivable in the way in which one ought to be running a justice system. It's not uncommon. Mr. Brass, it takes a routine kind of case of financial integrity, not anything having to do with the steamy sides of matter, and he breaks it up into 34 causes of action and says, I can get this guy for 50 years, but I'm only implying the law. You got prosecutorial discretion, and the most important thing for prosecutorial discretion is to make sure that when you get a case of great moment, that your legal theory is rock solid and your evidence is rock solid. And in this particular case, they're going hell for leather. The argument is, if I lose on this thing, I may be disgraced and perhaps influenced, but I could get the same case as I had before. So they treat this as a no-win prosecution. And it may be no-win for them, but it's certainly a desperate prosecution for everybody else on the other side. And what it does is it takes the entire criminal apparatus of the United States and calls it into question. So what you do is you have a crisis of legitimacy. Of course, you get over pushing on all of these kinds of cases. It's a very, very dangerous type of situation. And I think the only thing that you have to say, they should have never done it. And I think the Supreme Court will slap them down. In my view, it could even be 9-0.
And that slap it down will come in what form? I mean, will they declare that provision of Sarbanes-Oxley unconstitutional, or will they just say this is a misapplication?
It's only going to be the latter. I mean, surely obstruction of justice can take place. Mm-hmm. And if you start, you know, shredding commercial documents in order to clear your various kinds of offenses, as far as I'm concerned, that's very serious and ought to be treated accordingly. Mm-hmm. But the word corruptly means that you sort of do it without any kind of legal justification, right? And in all the cases that you saw of Siddons and so forth, there was no argument whatsoever that you can do it. This is not the case of somebody entering into the Capitol to save somebody who's burning or in serious medical condition and trying to take them out. Those kinds of removals, even if they're trespass, could be justified on some kind of a doctrine of necessity to save the life and health of other individuals, and therefore would not be deemed corruptly. But the burden is upon the government, let's put your point in more technical form, is the moment you should show a deliberate intention to disrupt procedure, the burden then has to be on the other individual to prove that he had a legitimate motive. Otherwise, the simple proposition is an intent to disrupt various kinds of proceeding will be regarded as corrupt, right? And so they are basically pushing this thing so far, it's just not a very wise way in which to proceed. They cannot win this particular case. As far as I'm concerned, they're just going way, way over the top.
Well, that and by the way, I'm sure that's the same sort of in-depth legal analysis we would have got from Joe Biden, who's also an attorney. Thank gosh we have you in the absence of Joe Biden. So that necessarily means that there are going to be all sorts of convictions overturned.
Yeah, because what they're doing is they're over-pleading on the obstruction ground. As I said, I mean, in these particular cases, you have fairly stringent requirements, and all they can show about these guys, they're walking in the building. And if somebody bumps into somebody else, the facts in this particular case are extremely strong for the defendant. And it's just tiresome to constantly hear people who are, you know, supposedly the forces of law announce that they have no political motivation. They're only doing this to enforce the law. The most important doctrine to remember in this particular case is that of selective prosecution. The government always has some degree of prosecution. If they select people for political reasons, it's against the FBI manuals, against everything else. That's just being done in all of these cases. Look, I'll give you another analysis. You want to find some really ugly stuff? There were people who managed to occupy for long periods of time government facilities in Seattle and Portland. Willful right. destruction of property, right?
Right.
And
right.
they never got charged. They were all released on their own recognizance. It's the asymmetry. People may not know what's right or what's wrong in all cases, but what they do understand is unfair treatment, where you really slam your enemies and you let your political friends go free. That's exactly what has happened in this particular kind of case. So I don't think it will stand. I think it's going to be, the whole thing will be blown up. And indeed, I mean, I can tell you what are the charges make that some sense, but in every case, even if there's some guilt, like with Mar-a-Lago, there are greater guilts on the other side, like Hillary Clinton, and the sanctions that they're asking for are much too heavy. And so the prosecutorial discretion is going in overdrive. And my view is it's likely to elect Donald Trump as president of the United States, because when the president starts talking about we have to make this nation safe for democracy, what he really should be saying, you have to make this state safe for democracy by keeping me out of office, because I'm managing to violate every particular norm that you could imagine.
I wanted to get the latest on your litigation in conjunction with Protect the Parks on the Obama presidential complex. You are pursuing a rehearing in federal circuit court. Where does this stand, and what's your assessment of your own case at this point?
Oh, I mean, we've had a thundering stream of big debates, and every case that we've lost, I thought, was essentially very badly argued and very badly decided by the bench. So if you're just predicting there'd be more of the same, given the enormous political clout that Obama seems to be able to exert over the entire legal system. But if you look at the opinions and try to figure out what's going on, the first thing you should do is look at the statement that the Obama Presidential Center writes when they're actually forced to confront this thing by my column in the Chicago Tribune with Michael Ratcliffe, being put in the Wall Street Journal, best on the stuff. And what they just do is they take a page out of their manual and they say, the Obama Center is designed to do everything that's just wonderful. Just to give you one kind of practical illustration, we don't know what the cost of this thing is. And it turns out, as best I can estimate from the very fragmentary information that they have available, there are at least $1 billion in the hole in trying to put this. And we're told by the court that we're suing as third-party beneficiaries. It's just an outright falsehood. The first thing we said in our complaint is this is not a third-party beneficiary case. We're not suing on this contract. We're saying this contract should have never been made, and it's a breach of public trust. It's a completely different kind of argument, and Judge Wood just completely mangles the thing and says that's not what it's at. You open this stuff up and you look underneath, but what are you going to find? You're going to find that it turns out their estimates as of September 2021 left them in the hole by at least $1 billion. They had a building that was going to cost $700 million, and they had nothing to pay for it. And they had an endowment fund of $470 million, and they put $1 million in it and said, well, we satisfied our endowment. But they have to fund all of these things, and they have no way to raise the money at this particular
time. Well, one of the other things, though, it seems to me, is that's unconscionable. So the contract is unenforceable. Is the acquiring the land that you suggest is probably worth $10 million an acre for $10?
Yeah, I mean, but
I think it's a deal like that.
Only one person, as we know. And what are they putting in the center? We don't even know the floor plan. There's said to be a floor is devoted to the residents of the Obamas. There's going to be a convention center. There's going to be a cafeteria. There's going to be a souvenir shop at one point or another. And there's probably going to be office spaces. But my guess is if you could actually see the plan, say maybe 25% of it is devoted to public exhibits. I mean, I have no idea what's going on, because the man who always prizes public transparency just basically plays rope-a-dope and doesn't reveal any kind of information about anything that's going on. You look at the logistics of this building, and they're a nightmare, because you have only one entrance, and it has to service four different functions. They have the huge security apparatus that they have to run. They got all their employees. They got all their suppliers and all their customers coming in through the same door. If they put it elsewhere, it would have been a very much more attractive building. He designed a building for them, world class, which they didn't look at, because what Judge Wood said, we don't have any power to stop this. And what we did 1,000 times is, Judge, you're right. The federal government doesn't have to tell them they have to run the project. It doesn't tell them they could locate it somewhere else. But the whole purpose of an environmental statute is to say if there's certain things that you can't do because they've been done well elsewhere, you can block it and then let them decide what to do thereafter. She said the original project mayor said we're examining the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park. But no, they changed the rules 15 months later and say all we're doing is looking at the road work at the edge of the park. And they say, well, the only way that you could handle this monstrosity in the middle is to essentially shrink the park and to widen the road. And then, of course, it just takes longer and longer. In her opinion, she said, well, they estimate October 2025. By the time the opinion was published, the date was now February, March, or April of 2026. You look at the building, it's a kind of a standing joke that we all have, is there are always the cranes there, but you never see them moving. Then the next day, they're in a different position, so you know that they have to move. And so and my wife drives by and thinks, and she looks at it. And she said, and no windows in this building. What's going on?
It's so ugly.
Said, well, what it's beyond ugly. Because what happens, they have no idea. What they always, I mean, what they do is they give you all these close-ups of people walking on the lawns in front of it. But they put it in the middle of the midway so as to have this spectacle. And what it looks like is it's a fortification. Prevent aliens from landing on the shores of Lake Michigan and taking over the city.
And where are people going to park?
They will put a parking place. No, I think the real question is partly that, are they going to come? They could park at the Museum of Science and Industry, and they have to build this parking place for their employees and so forth. Mm-hmm. But they will have, I think, 375 spaces, and there'll probably be spaces for 100 people in the public. Nobody is going to come there and drive. They'll take some kind of other vehicle, or they'll go to the museum. And in terms of business to Hyde Park, if there's one customer out of 100 that walks from the situation in the OPC to any of the restaurants in Hyde Park, it will be a minor miracle. They keep on boosting the huge economic stimulus it would give. And the great tragedy is that they put this thing west of Walking Park. They could have put it on land that was not public trust land. They could have had a glorious building. They could have had really nice access to the Green and the Red Line and to the Red Line Expressway and Martin Luther King Drive. And what they did is they put it into a place where it becomes utterly inaccessible, and it will not be any kind of stimulation whatsoever for the community that it's supposed to serve.
Yeah.
This thing is a travesty from start to finish. And what the Obama Center should really do is say, well, we may not have to disclose this stuff because we've given this protection, but this is what our building looks like. This is what our budget looks like. Are we on time? Are we over budget? They won't reveal a thing. Valerie Chadwick, all she does is she takes the publicity and answers all the specific charge with sentences that begin, our focus through this legal journey has been to protect the interests of our community.
The subtext is we want what we want and when and where we want it, and if you don't like it, so what? And do check out Professor Epstein's op-ed in the Chicago Tribune as well. James Freeman in the Wall Street Journal picked it up and discussed it as well. Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. 81 and sharp as ever. Professor Epstein, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
And have a blessed birthday. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Game on. Good morning, Amy here. Dan is gone for this morning. He had a very important meeting. So game when I say game on, I'm not talking about the WNBA or the draft that happened. I'm talking about the CTU. They kicked off contract talks yesterday with leaders officially laying out their demands. And this one's going to be different this year. Stacey Davis-Gates, CTU president, leaning on her relationship between the union and Mayor Johnson.
This is a brand new Chicago that we are engaging in. And the transition report from the mayor that we have now, that's where our contract proposals emanate from.
And they have 700 contract proposals in all. And with more on this and help us break it down, we welcome back to the program Paul Vallis, policy advisor now for IllinoisPolicy.org. As you know, former candidate for mayor and former CEO of the CPS. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Fine. Thank you, Amy.
Fine. So what did you, what I read from your inside scoop, which was reported by NBC5, they want a 9% pay hike as well as $2,000 newcomer package for asylum seeker students. What does that mean? Can we start with that issue first?
Well, look, clearly the district has been losing enrollment in dramatic numbers, and thus the union support for sanctuary cities and unlimited migration. So this is, I think this is part of their effort to capture that constituency and to fill the school district's ranks. I think half the schools are far from their enrollment levels, and a large number of the schools have only a small percentage of their seats filled. So clearly they're embracing the sanctuary city concept. It's a way to increase their enrollment after losing enrollment for about 20 consecutive years. Look, this contract is really all about, they talk about advancing the social agenda. They're talking about housing, incidentally, including in the proposal is housing for teachers, subsidized housing for teachers. But what Stacey Davis-Gates really wants is she wants more members, higher pay, less work, less accountability, and less school choice. That's the bottom line. That's what they want, and that's where they're ultimately going to end up.
Well, this 2,000 newcomer package, are they just going to cut a check to the kids' parents, or what does that include? That's just so bizarre. Are they going to give them, Visa cards or EBT cards?
You know, if you look at their, 170 proposals, it's littered with proposals just like that. They even speak to the issue of, they speak to a whole array of social issues that have no relevancy to what the primary responsibility of a school is. So, of course, they throw that out. There's no explanation. They're trying to capture the support of that constituency. But make no bones about it. Davis wants more members. That means more dues. That means more political clout. They want less accountability. There's nothing in that contract about adding a minute to the school day, adding a minute to the school year, closing schools and consolidating schools that are near empty. Manly High School last year had less than 100 students and something like 25 faculty. This whole community school, this whole sustainable community school model is all about maintaining a certain staffing level regardless of the school's enrollment. So this is just where she ultimately wants to end up is with more membership, more dues, less accountability, and less choice. Because in their contract, they also want to, in effect, phase out and eradicate charter schools. And as you know, they want to shut down the magnet schools. And they're even complaining about dual enrollment programs, and programs that allow students to attend college while they're in high school and earn dual credit. They want to eliminate any competition because it impacts their membership.
Yeah, my kids took part in that. They went to Truman while they're still at Amundsen, and that helped.
This school district that's spending almost $30,000 per student. $30,000 per student. There's been a dramatic increase in funding per student. I think only New York among the large urban districts pays more. Of course, the state of Illinois pays on the average 20 to 50% more per student than the surrounding states. Yet I think we're near last when it comes to Midwest and the surrounding states in academic performance. So while they're systematically asking for more, they're delivering less and less. Look at the abysmal test scores. Utilize it in Chicago. Only 11% of Black students are meeting state standards in reading, and 6% are meeting state standards in math. No wonder they're demonizing testing and calling it racist. They're spending $30,000 a kid, and they're getting those type of abysmal results. When the test scores are that low, that constitutes systems failure. Mm-hmm. Yet they destroyed the scholarship program that allows poor families to send their kids to parochial and private schools. And now they're trying to destroy charter schools, and which are public schools, by the way, of which 96% of the 54,000 students who attend those public charter schools are Black and Latino students, and 87% are come from low income families. I mean, that's, you want to talk about racism? That's one can strongly argue that the denial of school choice, the lowering of standards, is in fact blatantly racist.
Yeah, that's something you and Dan Proft can agree upon. But also, I think they're getting a little greedy, Paul, because they want a 9% pay hike, and the national average right now is 3.8%. So do you think Brandon, because he's such good friends with Stacey Davis Gates, I mean, I hear they talk every day, multiple times, and people always tell me, oh, she's always on the fifth floor, she's really in charge. Do you think that he'll cave to her, you know, every demand?
Yeah, you know, I think they're starting out high. I think between you and I, they already know where they want to settle on the salary side,
okay.
You know, and whatever it is, I guarantee this, it'll be a healthy increase. It'll exceed the rate of inflation, number one. Number two, the contract agreement will involve them increasing staffing levels. Do you realize that today the Chicago Public Schools has one employee for every 7.5 students and one teacher for every 15 students? You know, with those type of numbers, like, where are they? And despite spending $30,000 a student, only 54% of that money finds its way into the local schools. How's that money being spent? No talk about decentralizing the central office. No talk about, increasing the autonomy of principals and their locally elected school councils. So at the end of the day, you know, she's going to get a higher salary that's going to exceed the salary increases that you've seen the other unions negotiate. She's going to get more staff. They're going to get no accountability. They're going to continue to strangle public school, even public school choice, and they are going to make it almost impossible to hold students in schools accountable for poor academic performance. That's what they want. That's what they'll get, and that's what he will deliver to them.
It was so goofy yesterday, too. I don't know if you saw it. So they had this press conference, and then they all got on a trolley and rode by J.B. Pritzker's downtown office. But before they jumped on the trolley, Paul, this is what she said is going to happen by the end of this contract.
By the end of the contract that we're on right now, we'll have a social worker in every school. By the end of this contract, we'll have a nurse in every school. Those were things that we fought for in 2019.
I mean, I don't disagree. I would like to have a social worker in every school, and I'd like to have a nurse. And personally, we'd like to have an athletic trainer, but that's, you know, not going to happen. Do you think that they'll get that?
Amy, let me respond by that, you know, you can easily have a nurse serving two schools, particularly schools that are very small. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the social worker, why isn't there a social worker? When they're spending $30,000 a kid, but only 54% of the money that the school district gets actually finds its way into local schools, if they start anywhere, they should start at doing a forensic audit of the entire and an operational audit of the entire school board and make a determination on why so much money is being diverted. And even when you take pensions funding out and debt service, it's like $23,000, $24,000 a student. I mean, imagine that for a second. You know, look at that number in contrast to what the parochial and private schools are paying for their children, and yet having much greater success with the same demographic. So at the end of the day, you know, why aren't you having that now? It's the same thing with this community schools process. Let me tell you the danger of this so-called sustainable community schools. First of all, why aren't all schools sustainable community schools? Why are all schools open through the dinner hour on weekends over the summer and inviting community-based organizations that have legitimate programs to come in? That's not what they're talking about. Their sustainable community school model is about giving money to sustain staffing levels at local schools that are near empty or that are in losing enrollment. And it's also about allowing the teachers to co-manage the school and then to determine how the additional money is going to be allocated, who to contract out with, who to interact with, not the local school councils that have parent representation. No, they want to give the schools money and then let them use a good part of that additional money to help strengthen and expand the Chicago Teachers Union's local alliances. So this is a very expensive political document. It's just more evidence that the Chicago Teachers Union has really become a political party, if not the political party, and they're doing it to the detriment of the students.
You're right, and the union's gone on strike twice in the last 12 years. Do you think that's going to happen this time? I mean, this contract expires June 30th.
Oh, no. She's going to get what she wants. Look, he already gave her, $271 million. He gave her $226 million in TIF surplus revenues and, without asking for a concession in return. And then they decided to pick up the city decided to pay for their pension share into their non-teacher employee retirement. They just did it. They just the city just picked that up as if the city has an additional $46 million to spend. So at the end of the day, she's going to get everything she wants. I also want to make one other point, too. You talk about the strike. They threatened the strike three times. And as you know, because I did plenty of morning shows with you from time to time, even co-hosting about the shutting down of schools. And they closed schools for 77 consecutive weeks, and with devastating consequences, not only academically, but also social, emotionally, and devastating consequences when it comes to violence. Since the 2019 shutdown, there's been a 50% increase in murders of school-age youth, and 8 to 9% of the murders and shootings, the arrests for murder shootings, are school-age youth 17 years and younger. The one thing they have in common is 90% of them are not in school. If you take out the historic increases in violent crime among school-age youth, both involving school-age youth either as victims or victimizers, there's been virtually no spike in crime. So the crime pandemic that has swept the nation overwhelmingly in the so-called blue cities has been the direct result of the teacher unions across the state shutting down the public school system for 77 consecutive weeks. The parochial schools, incidentally, had no loss of academic performance. They met or exceeded their expectations. The charter schools, of course, in Chicago were also forced to shut down.
Yep.
But charter schools nationally elsewhere that were able to reopen and early on were able to have hybrid, they also had minimal academic loss. But this is just more of the same. This is the union asking for more and offering less. And I see that the present teacher union leadership as a clear and present danger to the academic, economic future of the students that they're serving.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul Vallis. Miss you. And I'm still licking my wounds that you're not the mayor, but it's okay. I'm watching Rome burn along with the rest of us. Policy advisor now at illinoispolicy.org. You can see some of his work there, and obviously former candidate for mayor and former CEO of CPS. Paul, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773 467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.